Welcome to Tilth Talk Radio. Today we're going to be talking about oilseed crops. In our spotlight, we'll take a look at some AI insights now available in John Deere Operations Center. Egg History Minute, we'll talk about the history of canola. Cool Beans, That's Corny, we'll have some current events. We'll wrap things up with a Field Good Friday. With me today are Bill Schomburg.
Hey, guys.
Todd Schomburg.
Hey to all the Tilthies out there.
And I'm Matt Brueger, all with Tilth Agronomy. Are you guys all recovered from the snowpocalypse 2026?
Yeah, starting to melt already.
It is.
The city, like some city roads still have 2 to 3 inches of...
like a permafrost layer on the roads.
And it's like pothole-y.
Yeah. And now it is turning into slush and it's even grosser. Yeah.
Yeah. This was the other day, but some of the side roads, still had a good solid film of snow on them too. And with this warm weather, it just, you feel like you lose traction just trying to... Intersections are the worst because I feel like there's a lot more intersections that it got snow left in. So, like, if you're not in, you either have to, like, be really far back or really far forward to not have issues, like, going.
Just put in four.
Just put in four.
It was almost like they just didn't have enough room to put all the snow either in intersections.
Right.
How do you put all that's in the intersection somewhere, and they kind of piled it up? And, credit the plows because they did a really good job in a tough storm. I mean, we're lucky we didn't have snow ahead of it, too much snow, and we're lucky this isn't like December where it's going to stick around and you really got to make sure you put it in a certain spot.
Well, and thankfully, unlike 2018 when we had that last kind of big snow, it was early enough that they didn't have the blades off the plows yet, because that time they had to like quick put them back on, so at least the plows were already in winter mode yet for this one. And they were called upon to do a lot of different stuff just to try to get things done, not only plowing the roads as normal, but escorting ambulances, milk trucks, like all, they were doing a lot of extra out there. So I was thankful
and unthankful for the wind at the same time. I was talking to a farmer yesterday and we were talking about that, was it 2018 when the barn roofs were
kept? yep
yeah,
like how different. You know, that one felt wetter.
Yes.
That snow felt wetter than this one. But also, he said, like, the wind, when this one, there was no chance for it to accumulate on the barn roofs.
Just totally keep piling up on the barn roofs.
Right, you just get drifts in areas, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Right.
But yeah. Any
if there's corners or...
anything on the south side of a building this year was you know, then this storm was more difficult. I did talk to some farmers that, made sure they'd pushing stuff out of that area, and then within hours it was back piled
right back
up.
But. Yeah. I talked to the gentleman that does the grocery store parking lot here in town. He just happened to be wandering through, and I know him pretty well, so I rolled down the window, was giving him a hard time, and he was telling me that as far as snow removal goes, this was, I think, Wednesday. He was still, like, busy enough, like there's still left places, like he was getting calls to go all these places, but his biggest head scratcher for him was Amazon in Greenville had got a hold of him.
Okay.
And they wanted him,
like the big hub of
the warehouse
centers. Yes,
they wanted him initially to help clear their parking lot.
Okay.
But then they changed it, they wanted him to help clear the Chaska Golf Course parking lot, which is
nearby,
on the county line there,
yep.
Because they were going to move a bunch of diesel generators over to that parking lot to charge their electric vehicles.
Oh man.
So it was like, green energy, that is what he said to me. I'm like, sounds about right. You know, you see all those memes of, like, guys charging electric cars with gas generators and stuff. But
Did he
so I don't know if that actually happened or if they cleared out enough before
Amazon.
But I just thought that was kind of funny.
I think the post, like, at least our carrier, I don't know about yours, but our carrier has one of them postal vans, and it looked like he was struggling
just to drive
get to mailboxes, and, like, I watched him go to three of my neighbors, and, like, he'd have to, like, rocker back and forth, and he was spinning just to get to the just get out of the mailbox area to go to the next one. It was crazy.
Even driving through Appleton, Ballard Road was a 1 3/4 lane for that, part of it. Like there was still enough stuff. Like
that is tricky with spots where spots are only kind of like north too. They're saying a lot of roads are just one lane.
Yeah.
They just plowed and yeah.
I got stuck next to a dually too. So I've got a 3/4 ton pickup truck and then there's this guy in a Dodge dually next to me. It's like, oh, there's barely enough room as it is.
Who's going to give? You playing chicken already?
Pretty much. But it'll be.
I was surprised that they can't, like, obviously lots of stuff for Monday, and that was understandable, but how quick they pulled the trigger for Tuesday. But then when Tuesday came, it's like,
well, like Matt said, there was still enough. The storm technically ended, so it was Sunday to Monday. So we run back. And then, like Matt said, if the snowplow driver or snowplow person, they were still doing it Wednesday still clearing out some areas and stuff. So that's how crazy it was. It was like such a long held out storm that when think of that, they were going like 4 days at it just to kind of move it make things.
And, you know, the first 2 days were just getting it out of the way so you could get into businesses. And the next 2 days were hauling all that snow out of those parking lots.
Yeah.
So you think about, you know, usually you have to take up some of your parking spots for snow removal in the winter. It just happens to be how it is. And that it can be hard enough with like just a 6-8 inch snow, let alone getting almost 30 inches in a shot. So plus the drifts and everything else. But it's also time for
basketball. Give me the ball because I'm gonna dunk it. Basketball. Give me the ball because I'm gonna dunk it.
So good luck to Seymour High School, who won their game yesterday and is headed to the championship game tomorrow. Unfortunately, the Bucky was not as fortunate.
Bill, you doing okay?
I'm doing fine.
Yeah. It's such always an abrupt and, like, people that don't like sports, I could listen and they're just like, why do you guys care so much? I think part of it's how it ends and you have, like,
well,
like only one team gets to win.
Right.
All of it.
So, of course, like, all of your teams are going to lose. It's just the way they lose, and then you try to justify the season. It really doesn't matter that much.
Well, and a 5 seed's a curse.
Drew.
5-12 upsets are, like, the most common, I think. I mean, yeah. I don't know the exact statistics, but they happen all the time, it seems. Every year there's a 5-12 upset. So it's kind of a curse to be a 5 seed in the tournament.
So there we go. We'll justify it that way. I like
there
that.
You go.
Yep.
Yep.
And they were in Portland, and they had to play at, like, 10 o'clock local time.
It was a weird, yeah.
What the heck?
Tell us how you really feel, Bill.
Yeah, I know. And they played well. That's the sad part. They played well enough to win, but they didn't make the plays down the stretch to win.
Yeah.
Like, that was their problem is I felt like in the second half, they weren't playing with any, like, urgency or care. Like, it was like,
so it was like the Green Bay Packers.
Yeah, it was just dumb, like, inbound to Blackwell, and he's not paying attention, and the guy behind him hits his hand, and the ball goes out of bounds off Blackwell's hand. And just dumb plays like that, that you're like, let's be a little more cautious and careful with this basketball.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I was in a meeting most of the day yesterday, so I didn't get a chance to see the game. But the final score, I mean, 82-83, so it seemed like it was close. But I don't know how much of that, you know.
They were up 10 at one point. It's like, okay. And I think there was like 5 minutes ago and they were up 8-ish.
So it did come down really to the last couple minutes.
And High Point started jacking threes and making them. And we were going down the field, down the court and missing layups and missing bunnies. And it just, they didn't, like I said, they just didn't make the plays down the stretch to finish.
They let rabbits on the court? That seems unusual.
Bunnies, I like that.
Yep. Yep. So, like you said, Todd, it's just like you're good, and then like 10 seconds to go, the guy that hasn't made a 2-pointer all season is streaking down the court, makes his first 2-pointer, and within 10 seconds you're done,
and the season's over.
Yeah.
And then the other team's a Cinderella best story ever. You know,
right? They'll get lots of
attention
until they either lose or
And their coach is pumping up his chest after the game.
Yeah.
Oh, nobody wants to play us, and we're better than we are, and blah, blah, blah. And then they'll get hammered by Arkansas.
Right. That's the thing is, yeah, can you really be considered the Cinderella until, I think you got to win at least two games.
You got to get to Sweet 16.
Yeah.
And then you're for sure a Cinderella, especially in today's kind of pay for players kind of thing. You get that far. You did pretty well as a smaller school.
All right. You guys ready to get into our topic for today?
Yep.
Well, as I said, I was at a meeting yesterday, and that's kind of where my thought process came from for this topic. So oil seeds, you might not even think about them.
I don't think about them usually. I mean, we're not in Canada, Matt, with canola, but
Ader.
There's Canada, or not just in Canada. Canola is grown in the U.S.
True.
Kansas.
But yeah, oil seeds can be cover crop, cash crop, or feed. And they're kind of an emerging market, I would say. You know, canola's been around a long time, but some of these other ones are emerging markets, and it's interesting just to look at the potential for what they are, because right now, especially with commodities, I mean, there's been some rebounds of late, but, you know, if you're looking to diversify your operation or just diversifying your crop rotation, these alternative crops might be something worth looking at when it comes to your farm's rotation. And
I'm excited about this because I do not think of them as feedstock typically.
Yeah.
So where are you going with that? And then, yeah, just obviously we do use them as a mix in the cover crop at times. And
yep.
In this year, I would say as a cash crop, it is not.
Well, and the first one is a little bit deceptive because it's maybe not as much of an oil seed, but the high oleic soybeans.
Oh,
because it's meant for.
All right. Yeah, we do that.
Oil production. Yes, that's a big one for feed. But
all right, you got me on that one. That one's good.
Other ones do have potential. So, yeah, for starters, high oleic soybeans really started when we were first introduced to them as an idea of it was going to be this oil production, fry oil. Every stadium in the country is going to want this fry oil because it lasts longer, doesn't give you the funky taste, like your cheese curds aren't going to taste like fish, like they do at Culver's sometimes when you get the wrong time of day. So
we're going there later today, so hopefully...
Hopefully your
not the late, not
your
the
onion rings don't taste like cheese curds. Well, actually, that one I'd be okay with.
Noon, good time, Matt? I mean, do you have that time?
I don't. I just know. I would say noon is probably safer than 1 o'clock. You know, anytime I get there
later,
like 1 o'clock's nice because there's usually not quite as much of a line, depending on location. Sometimes, like there's one in Green Bay that's always busy, it seems like. But... Yeah, you know what I'm talking
about.
Yeah. but yeah, you take that first bite and you're like, yep, that got fried with something else, or that oil's getting a little old. So that was the kind of impetus for this high oleic soybean was, oh yeah, it's going to be this big oil production side. And that part never seemed to take off yet. I mean, I'm sure it is being used. I'm not saying it's not.
It just didn't see. There was a big buzz around between 2019 and 2022 with a big push, like you said, to try to get it into stadiums and into more things. And I think, unfortunately, they realize the person that's by the fryer frying stuff is not the person purchasing the oil to fry with. Right. So there's a disconnect there of who you have to sell to and how to try to get it into more places. So hopefully, like you say, we can see maybe a rehabilitation of that or a resurgence of that need or something to be fulfilled.
Yeah, which in some ways it's a benefit because, as we know, it has taken off for a different reason, and supply has been somewhat of an issue, not so much that they don't have enough necessarily, but the on the genetic side, they don't have the everything up to the current level of trait packages and everything, and this year they'll have some that are up to Enlist, but they don't have enough for everybody to grow Enlist yet. So it became a feed source for dairy cows. And as they've told us, it's pretty much doubled the last couple of years as far as the demand for this. And a lot of it's on farm. And even within that, they don't even want the oil taken out of the beans a lot of the times because they want that as part of the feed so they can take other things out of the ration. So that one kind of, you know, was introduced, like we said, as one thing, but is really taking off in a different way, which is fine. It's good for that market, I guess, but just wasn't where we expected it to go. And even if you do take the oil out, the meal still has value as protein and stuff for other things, but it also has value in the diet. Another one, which is one that Bill and I saw a talk on, we're trying to figure out like 6 or 7 years ago, was Field Pennycress under the name of Covercress.
Okay. I was say, that's a weed typically.
It yes. is a weed, yes. And I have a couple fields that would be a good cover crop in.
You wouldn't even have to plant.
Yep. Yeah. Yep. So it went from a weed to an oil seed product. And right now it's mainly grown in Illinois and Minnesota. But one of the things that is kind of a running theme through a lot of these oil seeds, and it makes sense, is they're all kind of related to mustard. So they're in the mustard family. And so Field Pennycress, even though it's been, like I said, a good half decade or more of being on the market, it doesn't seem like it's really found its niche, at least not in our neck of the woods. A couple of our neighboring states grow it, but that one has potential, and yeah, we've all seen it in fields, and that might be why it makes guys nervous to grow something that they normally consider a weed. But it's another source for oil, and the potential is there for that to have a growth market. Canola is probably the biggest and most famous of the oil ones that we would know of. One of the most successful ones in finding a market. Canola oil is all over the place. You see it pretty much everywhere, every store. We know a lot of it's grown in Canada, but some here in the U.S., the Dakotas. I know that it has been grown in like northern Wisconsin, along near closer to the UP. I don't know that anyone's really done a lot of production of it to the south, but
I remember visiting with our parents, visiting some friends in Kansas, driving fields, and they had canola.
Yeah, so it's around.
Remember the canola? I remember the Milo or sorghum, a bunch of that fields.
Yeah, I thought there was some.
I'm sure there was too. Like you say, man, this one is a interesting one in that whenever I've gone or talked to like our agronomist friends up in Canada, this is like all they talk about is like their, you know, canola is their corn, like soybeans
yep.
is big for them too, but it was all about canola. How can they market it? China was another big grower or like,
China.
You know, they traded with them, but also China was starting to grow more of it. So
sure.
that whole kind of a market part for this one is always tricky, and Canada in general did a very good job of developing that.
Yeah, and in our Ag History Minute today, we're going to talk a little bit more about the history of canola, but this is another one where it's another part, you know, we know about the oil, but that we don't think about. Canola actually has a fair amount of protein as well. So even the meal that can be produced after the oil is taken out of canola, I believe from what they were saying yesterday, it's in the 38% to 40% protein range. So I mean, it's got its use there for the byproducts as well. And that's, I think, one thing that's important for all of these is it's great to be good at one thing, and to be successful, you really should be good at one thing and do that thing very well. But the more you can diversify and, you know, elevate that crop in other ways, the more value it can have. And so being a feed source, this one is probably this one and Higher Lake soybeans are probably the ones that are least likely to be used as a cover crop. Not that you couldn't use them as a cover crop, but they're far enough along the chain, you know, with the Roundup Ready traits and other things that you can find in them that they wouldn't make the best cover crop, especially from a germination standpoint. If you didn't think you had Roundup Ready canola and tried to kill it and found out you did, which I know Jeff Polinsky had a story about that, you know, thinking he had one thing and it's related to rapeseed. So you could get rapeseed that you thought was just rapeseed, but might have canola mixed in as well. So that one could be problematic.
If you had fully traded Hyolaic soybeans and you wanted to kill it because you, not that you would, but even regular soybeans, if you wanted to kill it as a cover crop, that'd be a little, it'd be a little tough.
Yeah. We've used it in like for cover crop grazing in scenarios where it's actually valuable to have the Roundup Ready trait, not necessarily Hyolaic beans, but soybeans in general, where, you know, then you can spray your corn and not worry about killing the cover crop if you do have weed issues, and it makes a pretty decent forage. I mean, soybeans, that was what they were used for before they were ever used for protein meal, all that kind of stuff was as a quote-unquote hay crop. So they do have potential, but those two are, like I said, not as common for that. Carinata is one that I didn't know a whole lot about until yesterday, and then I looked it up, and was I've heard of it as its other name, which is Ethiopian mustard, as a cover crop. That one, it's in these mixes and blends from a lot of these companies have their you know, preset mixes that they can sell you for whatever purpose you want. Like they have a warm season, cool season, deer mixes, all that kind of stuff. So Ethiopian mustard, like I said, it for me was introduced as a cover crop, but it can also be used to produce oil. And they actually grow it in Southeast U.S., like Florida, Georgia, that area. And again, it's in that mustard family. Its seeds can be pressed for oil. It has protein as a meal. So, I mean, there is potential for it. This one, canola, pennycress, winter camelia that we're going to talk about in a second, they're, I would say, more upright and kind of stringy, I guess, like branchy. They're not, you know, they're not big plants. They don't fill out. Whereas if you look up a picture of this carinata, it looks more like a cabbage almost type. Plant.
These are all in the cabbage family, so it's just right. Depending which parts of the anatomy elongate or don't.
Yeah,
it can look a lot like cabbage at times. This one's odd.
Camelina, I think they call it the rosette, is the base. Like it kind of has that, but it's not as big as the Ethiopian mustard. That one is probably the biggest one out of these, as in terms of like the base of the plant being fairly large.
Is this a new one for you, Bill, or not? This one specifically.
Carinata?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I didn't even know how to say it.
No. And so,
I wouldn't swear that I'm saying it right either. Ethiopian mustard, I'm pretty sure I'm pronouncing that correctly. Yes. But
I'm not so sure that like the carinata would have the same root structure as a radish, but I feel like the above ground properties could be the same protection. Yeah,
more leafy.
If you got thick enough,
yep.
Could be the same as well, radish.
And mustard is a brassica, and so are radishes. So yeah, it is.
Right.
They're all related in some way, shape, or form. If you go down to the base families of plants, it is always kind of interesting what's like. You think of them as individual plants, but you know, the families that they're in make sense when you do the deep dive. So I remember that from that presentation on pennycress that they gave us. You know, they talked about all the things that are related, like kale and all these things that are technically in the same family. But the big one, the one that was the focus of the meeting yesterday, was winter camelina.
All right.
That one's a emerging brassica, mainly, like I said, in the cover crop realm for us, but it has the potential to be a market crop. It's currently grown in the Dakotas, even eastern Montana, Minnesota, Iowa, Nebraska, Wisconsin, and Canada. And I think Kansas, they're looking at growing it there, or have grown it there a little bit as well. And this one, again, it's in that mustard family, has the protein as a meal, so there is some potential for feed, and has the ability to be an oil crop. But they referred to this, and I thought this was an interesting term, and you guys left, let me know if you've ever heard it before, as a shoulder crop. So it fits in outside of like the main growing season. So a lot of these, if you're going to grow them successfully and collect them, they're a rotated crop. You know, canola, I would say, is closely related to how we think of winter wheat in a rotation. Like it's something that is your dedicated crop, whereas the way they were presenting camelina yesterday was that it can be a in-between crop because you can still, even in our geography, double crop it or have the potential for other things.
So would you, you're planting this after the wheat, or you're planting this and then you're planting something after
camelina? The interesting thing with camelina is after wheat's probably a little too early.
Yeah. Oh.
The ideal placement for this would actually be after silage.
Ooh.
Nice. Like September, so similar to winter wheat, that planting window is kind of that September area, maybe early October. I don't know that I'd get much later than that when it comes to it. But
so it's going to be that fit when you can't do radish, but you're not baling to winter rye yet. Like,
right.
You know, you get to a point where all we can do is winter rye. This is like a little bit ahead of that.
Yes. Yep. It can fit in, like I said, that after soybeans or after corn silage window pretty well and be an alternative to rye if you're going to use it as a cover crop. But even if you're going to use it as a cash crop, that's also your ideal planting window. So what they've done, and there was a couple farmers at this meeting that talked about how they're growing it, mostly cover crop, but there was one guy that was relay cropping it. So if you remember relay cropping, I think we've talked about it on the podcast before, but the general idea was you'd grow like winter wheat, but you'd leave spaces that you could plant soybeans, then you take the wheat for grain and leave the soybeans then growing to get a profit off that.
Soybeans are already growing before you harvest the wheat.
Right. You plant the soybeans into your wheat.
Yep.
So this one makes a good relay crop because it flowers starts to flower in the beginning of May. So if you get it to overwinter, it's flowering early May. It's done flowering by the beginning of June or late May. And you can be harvesting it by the end of June. So if you were going to plant soybeans, you would still have a potential window, depending on geography and everything, to get a good herbicide pass in after your harvest on your soybeans and more time with the soybeans not in competition with your other crops. So you potentially could see better yields than you would in a winter wheat situation because you've got a whole month or more of growth where it's the primary crop. So that's why they're calling it the shoulder crop, is it can fit in that, or the other alternative is just growing it as a crop alone. And then you have the opportunity to plant like a sorghum or, you know, in a dairy situation, some other feed in late June, early July that'll still give you value in that field for the later part of the season.
So being that it's winter, so is this like you'd plant it after your silage, let it overwinter. Then if you're going to harvest, you harvest it in the next spring?
Yep, you would
then plant sorghum?
Nope, you would harvest it in early summer, so like June. So like if you think about it, like a triticale or yep. rye scenario,
yep.
it's a little bit later than that.
Got it.
So you probably wouldn't want to plant corn silage behind it, but you could still, plenty of summer left for like a sorghum crop or any other kind of annual, you know, summer annual type mm-hmm. forage. So it was very interesting to think about it that way. Like, I went into this meeting thinking, oh, we're going to hear about this cover crop, soil health benefits, all this other stuff. But in reality, they're doing this successfully in Minnesota, the Dakotas, other places. They can actually get, you know, the oilseed crop and another crop in the rotation. So it's a new avenue for people that are interested in relay cropping, for sure. Or, like I said, if you have options of other things to plant afterwards. So this one does not have to be rotated as its own crop. A lot of, like I said, canola, some of those other things that they kind of are. Now that you couldn't plant other things behind canola or wheat, but it just gives you a whole nother month of the summer season to think about. And the reason these oil seeds are really kind of being presented and pushed and you know, trying to find their way in the market is the demand for sustainable aviation fuel, or SAF. They're expecting that to double the demand for that to double by 2040. So within the next 14 to 20 years, they think they're going to need a lot of production.
I know about you guys, but I really think this is cool.
The sustainable aviation fuel?
Yeah, like, yeah. Like how much, like we were joking about the flight app that we kind of follow. And then when with the Iraq war, like how all these planes are in,
you like can avoiding literally, the area. Yeah.
Avoiding, well, if you look at that, you can just see how many planes are in the air at any one point in the world. Like it's yep. just, it's just bonkers how many hundreds of thousands of planes are there and how many millions of gallons of jet fuel they're burning. And it's like, wow, we got a better alternative that's going to directly benefit our clientele.
Right.
I think it's awesome. Sorry, side rant there.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, we've seen it with, like, soybeans and biodiesel. There's other avenues, ethanol and corn. Like, it makes sense. Again, it helps to diversify your operation because there's even if you're not using it for oil production, there's still avenues you can use it for. So the more we can use these crops in more ways, the higher a chance of there being an emerging market for it. And so many of these oils will fit into that sustainable aviation fuel market, and they need acres for production. And that was part of their selling point for Winter Camelina yesterday was it takes, and I should have grabbed my notes, but I believe it's 150 acres to fill one tanker truck of oil. So to ramp up production, they said 500,000 acres would be equivalent to about 1% of your normal oil production.
Holy man.
So it's not super efficient.
It's not super efficient, but they're working on breeding, on making seeds bigger, like plants bigger, to get more oil. But at the same time, if you can fit it in, again, that's the idea of this shoulder crop.
Yep.
If you can fit it in between crops, then you're more likely to produce it, and you know, you're still able to get other crops in there without right. having to dedicate an entire section of your rotation to this crop. So that's why Camelina might have this fit. Now, the challenges for these oil seed markets, and the reason, you know, like we said, Pennycress has been around for a while, you know, is seed supply, seed cost, is depending on how many people are really producing it for seed and where you can supply the seed. You get shipping costs, you get everything else. It's not, there's not, you know, winter camelina dealers going around like corn.
How many varieties of winter camelina are there?
Thank you. I did not talk about that. So there are several winter camelinas out there, and I'm doing finger quotes for the guys here in the studio because
he was. I saw it.
They said yesterday, Joel.
Okay, who's that?
The variety.
That's variety. Okay. I thought that was the lady you buy it from.
No.
No, okay. Yeah.
Maybe that's why it's called the Joel.
Or is it Joel? The dude you buy it from. Yeah.
Maybe. Maybe it's either. Maybe she was Joel and now she's Joel. I don't know.
In this day and age?
It could happen.
That happens.
So that seems to be the best overwintering variety. So there's other ones out there that maybe don't overwinter.
Okay.
And I can say from cover crop plots and other things I've only got a couple years of experience with camelina in that realm, and we have not had a lot of success getting it to overwinter. So now, no identifying that particular variety.
So before you're using just variety not stated VNS stuff in general,
right? Or it was just winter camelina, but there was no specific variety
where there is a variety available to growers in Wisconsin, Minnesota. That
could work. So you can like Albert Lee in Minnesota sells it. I think La Crosse Seeds has it as well. And then it sounded like there's more companies looking at offering camelinas. So you'll probably start to see more, just like we've seen with rye. You know, there's a lot more varieties of rye now and, you know, specific rye varieties you can use that are maybe a little bit earlier maturing or at least more consistent maturing. I imagine the same thing would happen with camelina where you'll have these specific varieties that are kind of tuned to where they're being grown. But right now, there's not a lot of information out there. It's a fairly new thing. That's why I think that's huge to know that Joel, you know, asking for Joel seems to be the one that's going to work the best. So cost, again, you're going to have it shipped in. There's really nowhere, like Lacrosse Seeds would be the closest one to us as a potential. And there's co-ops and stuff that work with Lacrosse Seeds. So, I mean, it's probably not as hard to get necessarily that as other things are. Like your Carinata, if you wanted to try to grow that, you'd probably have to ship it up from somewhere else. Chemical interactions are another thing. Right now they're working on studying carryover and plant back restrictions to try to see what really has an impact. Their highest success, and where they've mainly been studying Camelina, at least from the UW perspective, is after soybeans. And so they found through bioassays, it looks like things like Dual, which are sprayed later in the season, might have a little bit of an impact on it, but it seems to come through it. So they're continuing to do those bioassays, working with Rodrigo down at UW to try to figure out where it falls. Currently, their recommendation is to follow canola. So if you look at canola, because you're not going to find camelina on a herbicide label.
Right.
Canola is probably the best option for comparison when it comes to...
Oh, okay. I follow you.
Where you're going
to compare it to the plant-based restrictions of canola.
Yep.
Okay.
There are also some potential over-the-tops for crop management, but it seems to be, and a lot of these as cover crops, seem to have pretty good weed suppression. Giant rag was the biggest one they found was an issue that seemed to come through when they had whole fields of camelina for production.
Not the end of the world for us.
The UW book does not have canola in it. Did they give you any other crops to use that?
There is, and I think you have to Google it. I imagine it's...
It'd be on the label.
Probably from Cargill. They have like a planting guide for it.
Okay.
For the areas where there's bigger production. So there is a like a camelina guide you can use nice. Too.
The camelina guide. Right.
Yeah. And then probably the most difficult part of this, especially for us, is the distance to a processor. We saw that with hemp. You know, the Ohio Lake beans, they were kind of on the front end of that because we had, you know, they had identified those right away. You know, here's where you're going to take it. Here's who's going to handle it. So the nearest processing facility for this, so I already mentioned Cargill is the one that's kind of managing this. Where do you think, if you had to guess, here in the Midwest?
Nebraska.
That's a good guess. I would guess I'll go with Springfield, Illinois.
Nope. You guys are a little too far south. Give you a hint.
Cedar Rapids.
We were talking about how much of a pain in the butt it is to drive.
Oh, it's in North Dakota somewhere?
It's Fargo. Yeah, Fargo is the...
We're way south, Matt. Not even a little.
So Fargo
it makes sense too.
Is where the crush plant is and everything for production for the oils and the meal when it comes to winter camelina. So we're fairly distant. They don't foresee building a new crush plant, like if the market, unless the market really would take off anywhere closer, but they are hoping to get elevators that will accept it and get it on rail and make it a little bit easier. Currently it's trucked. And so if you produce it for seed to sell to the market, you're going to have to pay trucking costs to get it there. It's a small seed. A lot of these, other than the soybean, very small seeds. Think clover, alfalfa, like that size of seed, which is why it baffles me how that's a high oil seed when you think about how tiny that is. And they are working on breeding to get it bigger. So that makes planting and harvesting a challenge. You can't just use the old wheat head with the same wheat settings. It's one thing we do have going for us here in Wisconsin is there were areas of Wisconsin that grew clover for seed. So there is some experience with small seeded things here in the state, but they did have a combine setting kind of recommendation for a lot of these things. And as you can imagine, it's everything as tight tolerance as you can to get that little seed, you know, maybe even putting screens in to kind of help with it. And as far as planting goes, using the alfalfa box on like a drill.
Okay.
If you have something with a foam roll, like an S drill, those you could probably plant in the big box, but for most drills, you're probably looking at alfalfa box. And like we said before, a lot of these have will work as a cover crop, and they have soil health benefits, help with erosion. Most of these aren't overwintering, so if you like having something mixed in where you know you don't have quite as much biomass in the spring, a lot of these would be a good potential crop for that. And weed suppression. So one of the interesting things they brought up yesterday that I talked with Dan Smith, friend of the podcast, that they're going to be looking at is the weed suppression qualities of camelina. And they've seen it in Iowa against water hemp, which would be a big deal. And in the Dakotas, it does a good job on kochia, which is a big issue for them. But even above the weed suppression aspect, which I thought was one of the things that I think was the neatest, is in a soybean rotation, it actually seems to have an impact on SCN as well. So it could help with reducing those nematode populations.
Even as a more as a crop or a cover crop or either?
Either.
Just it's got to
get it out there.
Just get it out there. And I'm sure as they dive into it deeper, we'll find more answers to that as far as how much growth you need and how, you know, how well established, what percentage, you know, maybe a mix isn't quite as good as a straight camelina, depending on what the research shows. But it is very interesting. And like we just as a wrap up here, you know, so it's got cover crop value, it's got the oil value, and a lot of these are a good source of protein. They're currently looking at Dairy Forage down in Madison, the camelina, as a potential like forage crop. That one I have, until you get some breeding and maybe some bigger plants, I have a hard time seeing the machinery cost of harvesting it being worth the value of the feed. But it's still good to know what potential there is. I could see it more in a mix than straight as a forage potential. But yeah, so and the other thing they mentioned yesterday from the cover crop side is they see it as a complement or even a replacement for rye, because there is that little bit bigger window to plant it, and then you're not relying on rye all the time. You have options to either mix it or even supplement it.
Did they discuss drilling versus broadcast seeding or any of those methods of getting it planted?
They did, and it's what you would expect. If you're going to broadcast, you need moisture. They did find from a biomass standpoint, like if you're looking to get more biomass, drone seeding it or spreading it over soybeans at leaf drop, you get more growth.
Really?
Similar to, we've seen that with rye too, if you put rye out and, you know, it gets a little stringy because it's still kind of held back, but then once the crop is off, you get a little bit more sunlight and it's not going to grow as fast as rye. And then the other thing they mentioned is it's not going to take off and, you know, blow really huge. I mean, it does mature early, but its carbon to nitrogen ratio throughout its maturity profile doesn't really get above that 20-1. So most of that residue is going to break down in season versus a rye, where after it gets 18, 20 inches, you might see it yet when you're harvesting. This one should disappear relatively quickly throughout the season. So yeah, lots of interesting things in this market. So it's one to watch. Not saying, you know, it wouldn't surprise me either way, either if it kind of jumps and finds a hold, or if we see it take a back seat for a few years. A lot of it's going to come down to that demand for sustainable aviation fuel. If it builds like they say it's going to build, then there's potential for these to find their market. But all right. With that, we'll wrap that up and move into our spotlight for today. So earlier this year, Series AI Insights became available in John Deere Operations Center. So farmers can now view insights from Series AI in JD Ops. Well, the partnership between the two brands isn't necessarily new. Enhanced integration upgrades give farmers a more seamless experience. By embedding our insights within tools growers already rely on, we're making it easier to onboard faster, take action, and operate with more confidence from day one, according to Anubhav Sharma, the series director of marketing. Platform enhancements are engineered to address fragmented data ecosystems, a persistent challenge across the ag sector. And their goal with this integration is to help farmers move from managing data to be able to act on that data. Most notable improvement is the in-platform access to the insights, which allows farmers to view high-resolution imagery data from series within OpsCenter with information in one place. Drawing insights and informed conclusions becomes more feasible for its users. The platform also layers intelligent systems, combining series insights with the machinery, the application, and planting data. And they're structured to help farmers better understand crop health, input efficiency, and yield risk so they can take timely action. Integration of the features is a simplified field setup with John Deere's boundaries and data directly integrated into series, reducing manual entry and improving accuracy. So not a lot that you have to do other than look at the pretty pictures and try to make some sense of it. So, all right. Now we'll go into our Ag History Minute. So, we're going to talk about the history of canola. As we mentioned before, rapeseed and canola are closely related members of the mustard family, which are brassicas and are both grown as oilseed crops. All current varieties of rapeseed and canola were developed from Brassica napus and Brassica rapa. Rapeseed is primarily grown as a source of ursic acid, which is not edible, but is valuable in high-performance industrial lubricants. In the early 1970s, Canadian plant breeders used conventional breeding techniques to remove the anti-nutritional ursic acid and bitter glycosinolates from the rapeseed. Removing these compounds resulted in an oilseed crop that produced edible oil, low in saturated fats, and a very palatable, high-protein meal for animal feed. They coined the word canola, which stood for Canadian Oil Low Acid. So that's where the name canola comes from.
All right.
To describe a crop that is low in both compounds. Canada is currently the largest single producer of canola, with nearly 20 million acres grown annually. Because winter canola will not consistently survive Canada's extreme winter conditions, growers in the Canadian prairie produce spring-planted canola. North Dakota dominates U.S. canola production, accounting for over 60% of acreage in recent years. The United States has more than 1.5 million planted acres. The majority of this production is spring varieties. Improvements in winter canola varieties have spurred production in Oklahoma and Kansas. Oklahoma has become the second largest U.S. canola producer in recent years, with 10 to 20% of the acreage. With continued strong demand for canola oil use in food products and as a biodiesel feedstock, canola acreage is expected to increase in all U.S. regions. So, yeah, I did not know that was why it was called canola, but it's kind of cool. Yeah, Canadian oil low acid.
I like how they just, yeah, made their own. We need our own name. That's awesome. That is
canola, eh?
Canola, eh? All right, thank you, Matt, and thank you to our listeners out there. Please subscribe to the podcast and tell a farmer friend. It's very easy. Just search Tilt Talk Radio in Apple Podcasts or on your Android or Apple phone. Download Spotify, and there you can also search Tilt Talk Radio and find us. You can listen on your computer or smartphone browser. That's very easy, too. Just go to tilthag.com/podcast, and you can follow us on Facebook and X at Tilt Talk Radio.
All right. Thanks, Todd. Now it's time for some cool beans. That's corny with current events. So cool beans?
Cool beans.
Cool beans.
Cool beans. Our cool beans this week. Ranchers are rallying as Nebraska faces its historic wildfires. We talked about this, I think, once before, that a lot of burning going on out in the plains. With more than 800,000 acres burned, a grassroots network of ranchers, helping ranchers, is providing a lifeline of hay and hope for Nebraska beef producers. From grass hay to structures, water tanks, the loss has been monumental to the area. The rally of ranchers began when fire sparked as neighbors helped neighbors, working to slow the tornado-like wildfires as they tore across the sand hills in the Morrill Fire and through the canyons of the Cottonwood Fire. There are multiple stories of local fire departments, neighbors, and family members creating fire breaks and helping move livestock and equipment out of danger zones. It's been a remarkable, unprecedented response to stop this fire, and we've come up with an equally innovative solution for recovery, according to Nebraska Department of Agriculture Director Sherry Vinton. And she said that when you fly over it, it looks like the Sahara Desert. It's all sand after everything's burned off, so it looks kind of awful. But they are finding that the ability from other ranches to help and send help has been just as monumental as the amount of things that have been burned. So the Morrill Fire has burned 643,000 acres and is 98% contained. The Cottonwood Fire burned 128,000 acres, 80% contained. Then there's also a couple other fires that have done 35,000 and 17,000 acres and are 80% and 60% contained, respectively. But not only helping to stop the fire and move cattle, but just in general helping neighbor after neighbor is the story that's coming out of these fires. So in the face of tragedy, they're out there committed to helping each other and providing feed through hay. So there's a hay donations that have been making their way through, and they've received 150 loads of hay and have four times that committed to get out to these ranchers. So it's good that they have able to find supply and help each other out. So definitely some cool beans. On the flip side, or that's corny this week, as a result of the snowpocalypse or the blizzard that we experienced here in the state, Wisconsin dairy farmers faced a rare milk dump during the brutal blizzard as roads became impassable. Milk trucks had a hard time getting to farms and to plants and also even just staying on the road sometimes. Unfortunately, that was the story with even some of the snow plows. It was just some areas were very tough to manage. So as the powerful blizzard went through Wisconsin and brought us to a standstill, it shut off everything from, you know, grocery stores. I mean, my wife's work closed, and they never close for anything. So definitely there were a lot of things going on. But unfortunately, folks who are dairy farmers who couldn't get reached had to dump milk. 15-foot-high drifts were causing difficulty throughout northeast Wisconsin, causing roads to become impassable. Milk trucks couldn't through. Employees couldn't reach the farm. And so, unfortunately, the result was dumping milk because they had nowhere to go with it. So,
yeah, even hearing some that the milk plants themselves couldn't get employees there and yep. couldn't kind of process as normal and things like that. So it was a bit of a challenge and, just a tougher time to that storm can always cause other things that you don't expect.
Yeah, you don't. You never want to see a situation where you have to basically dump your profits down the drain. It's especially in tight margins and milk price not being great. It's not a great addition to your weekly duties as a farmer. So hopefully we won't have to deal with that again this year, knock on wood.
No.
But you never know. All right. Now we'll wrap things up with our Field Good Friday. And today we're going to be talking about an agribusiness talent council that promotes ag careers to students with a March reading program. So Workforce Development Agency is using March as reading month and taking that as a springboard to increase awareness of agricultural careers with students. So Carol Distel with the Agribusiness Talent Council of West Michigan said that when you're 4 and 5 generations out of the farm, the kids don't know where their food's coming from or just what they can do within the industry when they grow up. So she said the Spotlight on Ag Readers, or SOAR, initiative began in 2022 to pair elementary classrooms with volunteers to read an agriculturally accurate story to students. So it's not just reading the story, she said. It's part of it is that the person comes in and says, hey, this is where I work, this is what I do, and you can do that too. So you give them a taste of what they're doing, and they also have hands-on activities that go along with some of these stories as well. So throughout working with county intermediate school districts and local partners, the demand for readers has grown sevenfold over the last 4 years. Growing the program, getting kids that experience, I think, has been not only important for the ag industry, but the state's education, Carol said. Letting them know that what is a possibility for them, it's also a stepping stone to a lot of other things that we do. So, kind of a cool program. I know here in Wisconsin, we've got Adventures in Dairyland. I don't know how much, I used to help with that years ago, but I haven't been involved with it lately.
It's definitely still around, but those are programs just hard to find, get volunteers and people to do that. And luckily, mostly that's in fourth grade classrooms. And there's a lot of good farmers out there that do help with that and help with letting all those kids on their farm. And
Farm tours are a big thing, even outside of that program. You know, a lot of times at certain ages, the fourth grade with the Adventures in Dairyland or kindergarten programs, they bring kids out to the farms to look around and see. And not just, they see a variety of farms too. I know you can go to some bigger farms, smaller farms, robot farms, regular stanchion stall barns. I mean, there's a lot of different aspects to agriculture that have changed a lot, even in our lifetimes. So it's cool to have these programs. All right. Well, that'll do it for this week. Thanks for being here, guys.
Thanks for having us, Matt.
So this week we talked about oil seeds and their potential as cover crops, cash crops, or feed supplements. In our spotlight, we took a look at the Series AI Insights, now available in John Deere Operations Center. Ag History Minute, we talked about the history of canola. Cool Beans this week was, despite the historic wildfires in Nebraska, farmers are helping farmers, ranchers helping ranchers, and helping provide not only help dealing with the fires, but also feed and other resources for those affected. That's Corny This Week was the milk dump that happened during our recent blizzard. And our Feel Good Friday is programs like the Agribusiness Talent Council in Michigan providing a reading program to teach kids about ag careers. So thanks for listening, and as always, happy farming.